Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers' Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at the 2019 Festival.
Thank you, good morning. Lamentably, the last day of the Sydney Writers' Festival 2019. I hope we can replicate on stage our conversations backstage. They were fantastically ribald, incendiary, and we are here to talk about fire. And to be honest, this session could go anywhere, seriously. Fortunately, we have two great writers here on stage. Chloe Hooper is the author of The Child's Book of True Crime, the incredible The Tall Man, Death and Life on Palm Island, The Engagement, and now her amazing new book, The Arsonist, an investigation into elements of the Black Saturday bushfire disaster in Victoria in 2009. Now, in the middle, sandwiched or bookended by two Australians, and anyone who loves the New Yorker magazine will know the work of the wonderful Susan Orlean, and anyone who loves books will know her many volumes, including The Orchid Thief and now the majestic The Library Book, which has at its heart the catastrophic fire at the Los Angeles Central Library in 1986, and which has been described by one critic as, quote, a wide-ranging, deeply personal, and terrifyingly engaging investigation of humanity's bulwark against oblivion, the library. Now, we are linked in this session by trial by fire. Susan, your book most certainly is about a fire, but it's about a lot more, which we will examine in greater depth. But there are monstrous conflagrations at the heart of both of your books. I'm very, very interested to find out, and I know, Susan, you've said to a journalist you are not a pyromaniac, but I'm interested in understanding what brought you to these stories about these fires.
First of all, I want to say thank you for being here, and this is a delight for me to be talking with these two extraordinary people and talking with all of you. The course of me coming to this story was very much focused on the fire, but came about in a somewhat different manner, which was I had begun thinking that I wanted to explore the idea of libraries and why libraries mean so much to us, whether they still mean something at all, and exploring my own very rich memories of going to the library with my mom as a kid. This felt like a rather diffuse topic for a book. It felt like there was no narrative arc. Then I heard about the fire in the Los Angeles Central Library, which was the largest library fire in the history of the U.S. It destroyed 400,000 books, damaged 700,000 more, and it closed the library for 7 years. So that suddenly gave me a portal into the story, the bigger story that I was curious about, which is why do we care about libraries? Because having an incident that was so dramatic that in essence challenged the very thing that libraries do so well, which is they preserve our stories for eternity. And suddenly this was a case of that capacity of a library being destroyed. So it gave me a perfect entry point into a bigger story. And certainly the fact that it was something dramatic like an arson fire made it, just for a storyteller, very appealing.
I mean, Susan, you were raised in Cleveland, is that correct?
Right.
And spent much of your adult life in New York.
Yes.
But you came to Los Angeles, and wasn't it a situation where your son was doing a school assignment and he needed to interview someone who worked for the city?
Right.
So you went to the library.
Well, I should say, I assumed my son was 5 years old. He had this assignment to write about someone who worked for the city, And I, thinking that I knew my son forward and backwards, suggested that he interview a garbage man. And he, probably knowing he knew me forward and backwards, said, how about if I interview a librarian? And I thought, I am a really good mother. I mean... So we went together to the library, and on that journey, something about it triggered these memories of going to the library with my mother in a way that was so emotional that I really was sort of stopped in my tracks and thought, what is it about libraries that resonates so deeply? You know, on some level, you could dismiss them as simply being big buildings filled with books. What could be the emotion that they managed to convey? And yet, I think most people would say that there is a kind of connection that we have to libraries and to books that's almost human. It's that deep. And those memories of going with my mother are memories that I think are familiar to many, many people, which is going to the library with your parent when you're very young and for the first time having this sense of possibility, of discovery, of the serendipity of what you might find in a library. The fact that certainly for me, and I think for many people, it's the first place that you're allowed to have some independence when you're really young, that parents will let you run around on your own as opposed to being in a store or someone's home where they're kind of monitoring you. So to me, libraries felt, those trips were a magical ritual of my childhood. Taking my own son was an opportunity to sort of pass that emotion on into the future, which interestingly is what libraries do for us as a society, is they sort of pass our stories on to the next generation, and we believe them to be and expect them to be eternal, that libraries outlive the individuals who create the books in them, but that they last forever. So the idea of one burning down and being shut down feels like this is everything counter to the idea of what a library is.
And Chloe, where were you on Black Saturday?
I was in country Victoria, I suppose, the urban bush. And I mean, initially it didn't seem to be... We'd been warned around the state that this was going to be, you know, the worst day on record. There were, there'd been a week of 40 plus degree temperatures, and on this day there was a sort of gale force northerly wind, and there was going to be a wind change, which is all of the infernos since colonization have been on days where there's been a strong northerly that has then been met by a southerly burster, which, you know, gives this whole new store of energy to a fire. But it's sort of interesting listening to Susan talking about the library, because and why you would be interested in fire. I mean, I think we are all on some level wired to be fascinated by fire. We've developed, you know, as humans in lockstep with fire. And I mean, we have stories because we, you know, sat around a fire talking mm-hmm. to each other. And on the Sunday when it became apparent how horrendous these fires throughout Victoria had been, I mean, it was only sort of very slowly that it was revealed 173 people had died around the state. And initially it appeared that of the five fires where there were fatalities, that three had been deliberately lit. And I guess that was the question that It seemed incomprehensible to me that somebody could do this, and asking why would you light a firestorm was what got me going, and you fill a book with your ignorance.
You were quite quick though on the scene, weren't you, getting to the township of Churchill, for example, in the Lockyer Valley?
In the Latrobe Valley.
Latrobe, I'm sorry.
In the Latrobe Valley. Coal country, a couple of hours, 2 hours outside of Melbourne. On the Thursday after Black Saturday, a local man, 39-year-old Brendan Sokolok, was arrested. And it's extraordinary in itself that, there were 34,000 of hectares of houses and farmland and national park and plantation that had been destroyed, but that fire investigators can then walk through the scene and find, locate the areas of the fire, which were, a couple of metres. And there were two sites of fire, and that's what led them to believe this had been deliberately lit. But yeah, I travelled to the area shortly after he was arrested, but I didn't really seriously begin writing the book for another 5 years.
But you had some interesting encounters with the locals when you
that's right.
Turned up initially.
It's a horrendous thing to do, writers kind of satisfying their curiosity, especially in the wake of such a disaster. When I first arrived, the fire was still burning in some areas, and a lot of the roads were closed off, and the feeling in that region was, they had to get Brendan Sokolok out of town as quickly as possible because they were worried really that he would be killed by vigilantes, and so the grief and rage. I was sort of, driving along and I guess my bad driving kind of earmarked me as a kind of, sort of terrible sightseer. And I was tailgated by someone who just was furious and wanted me, I drove back home. And yet the fire was slightly less incomprehensible to me because this area was a rust belt, and the town, which was a incredibly depressed coal satellite township, ringed by these mountains which were now burnt, it's very bleak. And I now know that we have very high level of deliberately lit fires where the eucalypts meet unemployment. And as gruesome as it is as a writer to sort of place yourself in these situations, you can drill down in a story and hopefully, come back with something to share with others about, life in Australia in the early 21st century.
In your defence on that day, couldn't you have just put your hand up and said, it's okay, I'm just a writer?
I didn't get the feeling that was going to wash Matthew. Yeah.
Maybe that would be worse. Have like a white flag hanging off the back of the car.
There are, apart from fire, there are two extraordinary characters at the heart of each of your books. And we'll go into Brendan's story a bit later. But Susan, the remarkable and irresistible Harry Peake is in your book, and I absolutely adore just the first line of your book, and I defy anyone not to read on after this sentence. And it is, even in Los Angeles, where there is no shortage of remarkable hairdos, Harry Peake attracted attention.
Well,
who was Harry Peake?
Harry Peake was a person with remarkable hair, among other things. He was a young man who had grown up about 20 miles outside of Los Angeles, but in a very working class, unglamorous part of the far suburbs of Los Angeles. He was charming, he was handsome, he was well liked by everybody. He was a person very attracted to and determined to grasp onto a more glamorous life. He moved to Los Angeles with the intention of becoming a movie star. And I used to say he came to LA intending to be an actor, and then I realized that doesn't really tell you everything. He wanted to be a movie star. He was dazzled by the glamour of being a celebrity. He did odd jobs. He was a messenger. He parked cars. He did them all very badly. He had a personality trait that became very significant, which is he was a habitual liar. He always told stories about himself and about his life that were significantly more glamorous than the life he was really living. And he would typically say to his roommates, so they would say, well, you know, what did you do for lunch today? And he'd say, well, I had lunch with Cher. Or I had lunch with Burt Reynolds. And nobody believed him. Everybody accepted it as a sort of personality trait that he was an incredible liar. His desire to put himself in the center of drama is the big question here, because after the fire, he began telling people that he was there and that he had been carried out of the building by a handsome fireman, and it was a very dramatic and a remarkable thing that he survived. Then he tweaked the story and began telling people that he had started the fire. He, in fact, told arson investigators that he had started the fire. And I think that tells you a lot of what you need to know about him, which was his desire to make his life seem more dramatic overrode any kind of common sense, which would suggest that it's not a good idea to tell arson investigators that you started a fire, either if you did do it or if you didn't do it. Either way, it's not a good idea. The investigation zeroed in on him very quickly because of the fact that he began boasting to many people that he had started the fire. What's interesting, though, is he was someone who everybody loved, even people who he drove crazy, couldn't resist saying, you know, he was a great guy. He was a charming, lovable guy, not someone who seemed troubled beyond his own inability to tell the truth. Nobody who seemed, he didn't seem malicious. He didn't seem angry. He was charming. But he also had this almost completely self-defeating tendency to need to put himself in the center of drama. And in this case, he made a very bad decision. He also made an additional bad decision, which is over the course of the investigation, he came up with not one, not two, but seven different alibis. And if people say to me, did you learn anything while working on this book? I think the one thing I did learn is if I'm going to commit a crime, I should come up with one alibi and stick with it. It's superior to coming up with seven alibis. It doesn't increase your credibility. It probably divides your credibility by at least 7%. But the other thing about Harry Peak is, in as much as anybody can be an archetype, he to me represented a certain kind of young man who is drawn to Hollywood. The best looking guy in their high school class, the kid who everybody thinks is marked with something special. And Hollywood is right there beckoning and promising a life that's unimaginable if you're growing up in a sort of dreary suburb, and suddenly here is this life that Hollywood seems to be dangling in front of you, which is this, you could have this life.
Yes.
If you're good looking enough, if you're charming enough, if you just get that lucky break, that could be your life.
And he died quite young, so there was. But you did track down his family and spoke to family members to fill in the details of his life.
Yeah, I mean, when I began the book, I didn't realize that he was not alive. And my first reaction when I found out that he had passed away was that I couldn't possibly do the book. I mean, how could I do the book without being able to talk to him? Then I realized that, of course, I mean, we've all written books that include lots of characters who you don't get to talk to primarily. And I was able to talk to his family, to talk to his friends, his ex-boyfriend. But yeah, he died in his 20s, which is a part of the story that was really tragic. I mean, this was 1986 when the fire took place. At the time, HIV/AIDS was a death sentence. He unfortunately had HIV/AIDS and died because there were no treatments at that time.
Incredible. Brendan Sokolov, a sad story as well, a bit different to Harry, but indeed a not a happy trajectory to that man's life. He is the convicted arsonist in that. Yes. In the fire you're writing about, he's in jail.
Yes.
Tell us about Brendan.
Well, you know, they're interesting people side by side, because I suppose if Harry was kind of kissed by the gods in some ways, Brendan was snubbed by the gods. If Harry was somebody who everybody loved, Brendan is somebody who almost everybody hated or, you know, shunned or wanted very little to do with. He was, his mother realized that he was different to other kids around kind of kindergarten age. He started school with very little language and still unable to sort of manage some self-care activities that most five-year-olds would be able to do. So he was developmentally delayed. There wasn't very much to do in this coal mining town, and so his mother told me about taking Brendan to a kid's sort of soccer, club, and all of his schoolmates basically setting on him and kicking him, and none of the adults intervening. Mm. And there was very little to do in this town. And so the next week she brought him back and the same thing happened. And Brendan was diagnosed 3 years after his arrest. So at this point he would have been 42 with as being on the autism spectrum. And having a mild intellectual disability. So this was unknown, and he was instead in his community a misfit who would basically travel around the foothills of the Strzelecki Ranges, which is where he lived, collecting scrap metal, and he would, take it home or what he couldn't sell, he'd be tinkering with in his shed while his neighbours, and often burning it. And his neighbours would meanwhile hear him listening to Thomas the Tank Engine episodes and or Bob the Builder.
A different guy. Yeah. Well, it is interesting that that we are talking about, as you say, one person who seemed as if stardust had been sprinkled on him. That in spite of everything he did wrong and all of the mistakes he was constantly making, everybody always forgave Harry. Mm-hmm. He had that ability to charm people, yes, and be beloved.
Yes.
Whereas Brendan couldn't do anything right.
No, and I mean, it's funny because Brendan also told very tall stories and would, and in which he would insinuate himself as the hero.
Yeah.
But he wasn't a kind of lovable fantasist.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's also interesting how many, there's a phenomenon of hero fires.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Which are fires that people who are fire starters start in order to put out and look heroic.
That's right.
And there was some speculation that Harry might have started the fire in the library with the intention of putting it out,
yes,
looking heroic, which, yeah, would fit his personality,
yeah,
and that the fire got out of control and he suddenly thought, this is, I got to get out of,
yes,
here.
Yeah.
I mean, that was one theory that, yeah, I think was fairly credible,
yes,
actually.
Well, I mean, Brendan was obsessed with the Country Fire Association, which is, Susan, the sort of volunteer organization that, mm-hmm, in most country towns deals with fires.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been, you know, he'd finished school unable to read or write, and he had joined up the local, with the local CFA, which in a lot of towns is the kind of one forum for, you know, it's a hub of community socializing. And he was discharged 8 months later for dishonorable conduct, and it was suspected that he was lighting fires, but he was never, you know, now if that happened, he would be referred to a whole lot of social services, and instead no one really even kind of made a note of it down at the police station.
They just kicked him out. Yeah.
But, you know, Brendan was one of the first people to call this fire in. And that is very sort of typical behavior of,
right,
of, and he then sort of, you know, he'd been horrendously bullied. So revenge is often an element of fire, mm-hmm, setting. So it's entirely possible that he, you know, wanted to revenge those who had made him feel like shit all his life. And then, you know, fight this fire and save everybody and be a hero.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it is very complicated psychologically.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fascinating in both, by the end of both of your books, and you both worked for years on these individual books, that with Harry, was he the arsonist or was he not? We don't know. With your man, Brendan, he was convicted by a jury.
Yes.
But there's still...
Well, Brendan denies setting the fire himself. He maintains his innocence and claims that he was, you know, the confession that he gave to the police. And of course, you know, his lawyers are very conscious of false confessions by intellectually disabled people, that he had been driving and he'd been smoking and he'd caught a bit of ash in a napkin and thrown it out the window, and a conflagration had started, which as a good citizen he'd called in. So
yeah.
But arson's very, very difficult to prove, isn't it?
Well, certainly in the US it's the least successfully prosecuted of all felonies. And it makes sense when you consider that not only is the evidence quite likely to disappear in the fire, but it's so easy to start a fire. I mean, it would take nothing to start a fire, as opposed to committing a murder where there's going to be a significant amount of effort that could be traced. It's also... something where it's very difficult to distinguish between a fire that's been deliberately set and one that occurred naturally. And that became something that I pursued in my book, because there was there's a lot of revisionist analysis now of arson, and many, many instances where fires that were believed to be arson were later proven to have occurred accidentally and not through arson. And so there was always the question, the library in 1986 had been suffering from benign neglect for 20 years. The building opened in 1926. It really needed significant repair starting around the 1960s, and it didn't really get the repair and the renovation that it needed. It had multiple fire code violations that were on the books, some of which were certainly wouldn't have led to a fire starting, like not having the proper signage for an exit, that kind of thing. But the wiring was absolutely outdated. The number of books in the building was about double what the building was meant to hold. So you have stacks and stacks of books everywhere, which basically is like setting the scene for a huge fire. Mm. It occurred to me, and it was an avenue that I pursued, which was, in the long run, was it an arson? Are we sure it was an arson? Because the way we analyze arson now has evolved quite a bit since 1986. The forensic science around it has gotten much more sophisticated. And there was a big rush to declare it an arson. It was within a few days where the city said, well, this was an arson, and now we have to find who did it. There is this notion that occurred to a number of people that the city knew that the building was in bad shape and didn't want to essentially take responsibility for the devastating fire by saying, you know, it was an accidental fire caused by the bad wiring that we should have fixed long ago.
Yeah.
So in a way, saying it was an arson meant the city had no responsibility, basically. Do I believe that it wasn't an arson? I mean, part of what made this book challenging to write is that it's not, and I'm sure you experienced this a little bit too, it's not, there are no absolutes. Everything from did Harry do it or not, was it an arson or not? I mean, the one thing we know for sure is we can look at the amount of damage and know absolutely that this devastating event occurred. Everything else gets a little bit squishy.
It's very interesting because I guess we're talking about, you know, arson in a building and then wildfire arson as well. And there is a crossover because I'm going to start off by saying that after these fires, the Australian Institute of Criminology went back and looked at their data for 280,000 grass fires in Australia, and they believe that 50% of these fires were either maliciously or suspiciously lit, and yet we only catch 1% of arsonists. So it's, as you say, it's an incredibly difficult crime to prosecute.
Yeah, and it's also, just as an aside, so often the people who are starting fires, or I shouldn't say so often, not infrequently, it's people who are in the firefighting community.
Well, that's right. Yeah.
Who...
Well, it's actually that it's very it isn't very common to have somebody who is a firefighter who is an arsonist,
right.
But it is very common for an arsonist to have links to to a fire.
That's
fighting
a better,
organization.
Better way of putting it. I hope there are no firefighters in the audience. Really,
no,
wait a minute, I'm not an arsonist,
yeah.
But. There is a connection.
But there is in Australia, I mean, because obviously our flora is designed to, you know, to burn. There is an enormous amount of paranoia about about fire setting and fire setters. And, you know, it's we want to find a monster. And actually the reality is that in this fire, 161 people died because of failures of our in our electricity grid, that power lines came down that were poorly maintained, trees fell on power lines that arborists should have noted needed to be cut down.
Yeah.
And so,
This is a way, as it happens, where California and Australia
yes.
have so much in common.
Yes.
While I was writing this book, there were several instances of horrendous wildfires in California. In fact, I found some poetic sort of resonance and coming out of my writing studio one day, and there's ash raining down from fires that were burning in the Santa Barbara and Malibu area. Mm. So we actually, I think of these as places that have similar vulnerability
yes.
to fire
yes.
and a sense in California that fire is this wild animal
yeah.
that's prowling and just waiting for a chance to pounce.
Well, and also, I mean, you have, you know, recently discovered that the last fires were connected to electricity
yeah.
Failures, and yet you've got a issue with, you know, as in Greece and Spain and Portugal, where we've imported the eucalypts.
Right.
There is also a kind of fit between the social issues that create deliberate fire setters and the vegetation to, you know, unfortunately make
yeah.
a kind of social and environmental conflagration.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's talk about the fires, because yeah. they're some of the most terrifying passages in these books. External bushfire or wildfire, internal fire. And you've done some incredible work and research on those individual fires. In the library, the colourless, perfect fire. Can you describe to us that the monster that that fire became?
The fire started in the morning of April 29th, 1986, and it started slowly. In fact, the fire alarm had gone off in the building. The fire department had come, had done a walk around in the building, didn't see anything, went to reset the alarm, couldn't reset the alarm, which made them think, well, let's do another walk around. They went into the stacks, which are these areas of a library where the books that are not out on the shelves are stored. And very traditionally, these stacks are small rooms that go up many stories high, and they're just lined with books and bookshelves. And in the case of the library, they were just overstuffed. The firefighters went into the stacks and saw a tiny thread of smoke. Thought, uh-oh, something's going on here. In a minute, that smoke exploded, and it began burning furiously. It had a perfect setting, because it's in essentially a chimney. It has unlimited fuel, because these books are just perfect for fuel. And it burned at temperatures of 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit, which I believe is around 1,400 degrees Celsius.
That's too, I don't have that
I know,
kind of brain.
I'm only saying this.
It's too early in the morning,
I'm
Susan.
Not doing the math that somebody told me this. And it burned at such a fierce temperature that the flames lost all color and they were just completely clear. And several of the firefighters I spoke to said they had never seen anything like it before, that fire is often red or orange, or if it's very hot, it can look blue. This was clear. It was burning in what is called a stoichiometric combustion, which is that there's exactly enough fuel and exactly enough oxygen for the fire to be sort of a perfect combustion. And it burned that hot for 7.5 hours, burning through the stacks, up, crossing over into the next, the stacks in the building, there were 4 separate stacks, and the fire crossed over, went into the next set of stacks, eventually got so hot that it just blew out windows, I think almost as if it was just trying to get some fresh air to get hotter and hotter and hotter. The firefighters could only stay in the building for 10 minutes at a time because it was so hot. And at one point, every single firehouse in the city of LA was gathered at the library in an attempt to put out this fire, which they couldn't figure out how to put it out. I mean, in a way, a fire in a building presents very different challenges because it's got so many places to hide. Mm. And certainly in the library, which was a building from 1926, built with many tiny hiding places and nooks and crannies, the fire was sort of sneaking around, and the firefighters were chasing it like chasing an animal. Mm-hmm. It's kind of remarkable when all is said and done that they were able to put it out, because they did at some point write off the building and assumed that it was going to burn to the ground.
Now, it started in the fiction section, is that right?
Yes, it did start in the fiction section.
That's why we can trust nonfiction.
I mean, the nonfiction, I have to say, someone said to me, if your book had been in the building at the time, would it have burned up? And I said, no. No, the nonfiction was fine, which tells you, why it's better to write nonfiction.
Right.
But there were huge sections of the library were lost. Like, all of the fiction from A through L was gone. All of the theater, all of the business books, all of the science. They had the largest cookbook collection in the United States. That was all gone. They had the only complete collection of patents west of the Mississippi, and that dating from the 1700s, those were all gone. Massive portions of the library, and then there were things that were badly damaged by the water being used to put out the fire. And this, to me, is one of the saddest things, was the library has a very large photography collection. They had just put labels on 12,000 photographs identifying what the photograph was and who was in it and where it was taken. All of those got wet and fell off. So 12,000 photographs that had been indexed and labeled suddenly lost their labels. So it was a profound devastation for the library.
And the surviving volumes were frozen for years.
Right. I mean, there were 700,000 damaged books, and those were primarily damaged by water, which, of course, was inevitable. If a book is wet, you have about 48 hours in which you can either try to dry it, or it will begin to mold. And if it molds, it's a total loss. So your alternative, if you aren't able to dry it immediately, is to freeze it. So the city decided we've got to freeze these books. Then there's the problem of who has a really big freezer for 700,000 books. The city has a large frozen food industry, and they had these giant warehouses, and these companies agreed to take in these 700,000 books. I'm sure most of them thought it would be for a few weeks. It was for 6 years, and the books were frozen alongside like frozen broccoli and shrimp. So some of the books, even now, I've said to people, if you find a book at the library that smells like broccoli, it was probably one of the books that was frozen. They were frozen for that many years because it took that long to raise the money and get the technology in place to try to dry them. And when at the point where they were ready to undertake this, it was the largest book restoration project ever undertaken. Remarkably, and I do think it's remarkable, the majority of those wet books were saved. They were, it went through an elaborate process of having the water drained out of them, and they were rebound in many cases, but many of them survived. So if you happen to go to the LA Library, which I recommend because it's an amazing building, but many of the books that you take off the shelves may have been books that lived through the fire.
Fantastic. And Chloe, what did you learn about Australian bushfires and one of this magnitude? I mean, this was horror of the first degree, wasn't it?
That's right. Well, I was looking, although there were hundreds of fires around the state that day, I really was looking at this fire that had taken place in the Latrobe Valley, which, as I mentioned, is coal country. And the town that Brendan had grown up in was right in the shadow of Hazelwood Power Station, which until it was decommissioned in 2017 was the dirtiest power station in the OECD. And that's where his father worked, and they bought a house with a at a affordable rate because they were power workers, as were their neighbours. And it really struck me that, all around, these are the largest brown coal fields in the world. So here is this geological substance which is incredibly volatile and combustible. And the irony was driving to speak to people, who were connected to this fire while passing a power station which was creating the environment socially, because we, there's a lot of material about resource extraction sites and social issues that happen around them for communities. And also it was, pumping out carbon that wasn't actually properly monitored, that would environmentally make these fires that become feral, that we're now seeing, globally more prevalent. So I guess originally this continent, which was a burning continent, there were fantastically sophisticated indigenous fire regimes. And, we now, which controlled for these kinds of infernos. And I was very struck by the ecologist Stephen Pine, the great chronicler of fire, talking about us putting flame in the wrong places, into the sort of bestiary of machines, rather than, looking at indigenous fire practices, which is, the same also in Northern America.
Right, right.
Now, before we go to questions, Susan, you committed a minor felony in the research for this book, didn't you?
I did, and I'm brave enough to tell you all about it. I had made a decision that I wanted to burn a book. I did it not to be sort of silly, but for real reasons. I mean, number one, I was going to be writing about 400,000 books being burned, and I realized that I had never seen a book burn. And for the sort of visual reference, I thought, well, I should burn a book so I know what it looks like. I also really was curious about the profound discomfort I had around the idea of burning a book. I can't even throw a book away, let alone burn a book. But it made me curious to understand why through, and I'm talking about a long-standing, ancient sort of taboo, that burning a book is something that affects us as people in a very deep way. It's a some kind of statement of erasure, of a kind of anti-intellectual gesture that makes us incredibly uncomfortable. So I thought, well, that's what I'm all about, doing things that make me uncomfortable. So I thought, I'm going to burn a book. Now I have to pick a book. So I thought, well, I'll burn a book I don't like. And then I thought, that's horrible. I'm not going to burn a book I don't like. So I thought, well, I'll burn a book I like. And then I thought, well, that's much more horrible. I don't want to burn a book I like. So I thought, well, I know. I'll burn one of my own books because I have a lot of copies of those. And then I thought, I'm not going to burn one of my books. I mean, that's outrageous. So I thought, I'm not going to burn a book. I mean, it was a good idea. I felt there was a really good justification for doing it for the sake of reporting. But honestly, I couldn't pick one. And I thought, I just can't do this. So one day my husband came home and he was just looked very pleased with himself, which isn't all that unusual, but it seemed, you know, I didn't know what the occasion was. And he handed me a copy of Fahrenheit 451. And he said, I think I've got the book for you to burn. It was especially appropriate, and I should just throw this in, because besides the fact that it's a book about burning books, Ray Bradbury didn't have the money to go to college, so he spent 14 years, by his own account, in the LA library every day, reading his way through the books of the library. He loved the library, he loved that library in particular. He wrote Fahrenheit 451, not in the LA Public Library, but the library at UCLA, where they had rental typewriters. He was very proud of the fact that he spent $9.27 or something like that writing Fahrenheit 451 in the typewriter room. But it seemed really appropriate. In addition, he ended up getting very involved in the fundraising effort to restore the library after the fire. So I lit Fahrenheit 451 on fire. I believe Ray Bradbury was smiling down from the heavens on me. And all I can say is, there's nothing left. It burned in 1 second, which really made me realize how incredibly combustible books are. 1 second, and it was gone. I was there with buckets and buckets of water, because in California, to set something on fire, you think, I am pretty much doing the worst possible thing I can do. So I had my husband and another friend there with these buckets of water ready. There was nothing left. It was absolutely gone in 1 second. And it was thrilling in the way that anything that dramatic, especially involving fire, is. And it was also incredibly shocking to see this book full of story and the work of a human being that was, you know, written to communicate to other human beings, gone in 1 second flat. And it was an amazing exercise.
Fantastic.
Don't bust me, though. I'm not 100% sure that what I did was illegal, but it probably is illegal to set a fire in California. So I'm telling you this since I feel very
between
close.
Between us.
I feel very close to all of you.
We won't repeat it.
We have 5 minutes for questions, so please take the opportunity now.
There's a
we have some mics roaming around.
Oh,
thank you. Matthew described the descriptions of fire in your book as terrifying, and I found that. And in fact, I had a physical reaction to some of the descriptions. I felt my heart rate increase, and I'm sure I wasn't alone. How do you find the language to describe fire, and did writing it have an impact on you?
Great question.
I was very fortunate that I had access to the brief of evidence where those in the fire's path described the fire coming towards them, and I sometimes just took five words that one person had said, and I actually there were sort of hundreds of accounts, and I've strung them together to give a sense of what it would be like to, as the incredible noise and heat and light show of this event, and the kind of the terror as birds fell from the sky and started spot fires, or as people in houses found the fire coming through their skylight, or you know, under the door, and it is like bestial. I found it a challenge to always try to have the same, you know, energy, to try to depict the kind of energy that that a fire, you know, has, in even in the smallest way on the page. And that was a kind of aesthetic challenge, but you know, it is very intense material to live with, and when you put the last full stop in and can kind of, you know, have done your part, then that was a relief for me.
I similarly had the fire department report, which gave a minute-by-minute log of what the fire was doing, where it was moving, how it was moving, and that was really helpful. Also, the insurance company did an investigation where they had a moment-by-moment account. I then spoke to many, many of the firefighters who were working on it. When I sat down to write it, I think, as you say, it's sort of there's a bestiality to fire. I wrote about it as if it were an animal. I felt like there's something about fire that seems completely animate and purposeful. It wants to live, it wants to grow, it wants to move. All of these felt so much like the attributes that you would imagine connected with a living being.
That's right, and fire investigators, you know, use the head of the fire, the flanks of the fire,
yeah,
the tail of the fire.
Yeah.
So they are, you know, in there, the fingers, they are forming a kind of a nursery book monster.
Yeah. Yeah, and it did seem like a monster that was ravenous and just wanted to grow and grow. In fact, it's interesting because probably our image of monsters is based on observing fire more than it is the other way around. Mm. But it was challenging, but also, you know, fire is incredibly beautiful.
Yes.
And that made, if it were some horror that had no redeeming aesthetic kind of appeal, it would have been even harder to write. This had also this gorgeousness
it's transfixing.
Really, yeah.
But I mean, the human folly is to believe that we can control fire.
Yeah. But that was a part of the book that I spent an enormous amount of time just trying to get it right, because I felt it was so essential to making the book work.
Thank you. Sadly, we've run out of time. It's been the greatest pleasure to listen to you, Susan and Chloe. These great authors will be signing their new books in the signing area, but please thank Susan and Chloe. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and rate our channel.